This morning I have so many special treats, and when my day is not as happy, things like this make me happy. Because I am privileged to introduce to you our community partner, Daniel Nguyen. Daniel is an environmental justice coordinator, and he is the director of the Fiat Village Urban Farm Sustainable Agricultural Park. He manages not only that park, but he also manages and teaches us and our students about aquaponics. He is a community organizer, but he's also a researcher. He's part of our team, has been part of our team, the Tulane team, for many years now. And he helped to collect, and you'll hear him tell his own story, shrimp samples so that we can answer the question, the very questions that Dr. Nicole Lurie talked about. With him will be Dr. Jeff Wycliffe. Dr. Wycliffe, I am equally privileged to have on his team, on our team, because he's a real bench to trench guy. Now, what does that mean? He is a genetic toxicologist with expertise in mutation research, risk assessment and modeling, but also molecular epi. But he takes that lab science and brings that to the community, and he works with the community to answer those very complex questions that we talked about earlier. He's an associate professor in the Department of Global Environmental Health Sciences, and together they'll tell you a real story. Beginning with Dan, Daniel, right?
Thank you, Dr. Nguyen. Good morning, everybody. So my name is Daniel, and I'm the project director at MQVN Community Development Corporation. And today I wanted to talk a little bit about roles of community in post-disaster research, and specifically our work in the Vietnamese community in eastern New Orleans around the BP oil spill and seafood safety. So the following personal financial relationships with commercial interests relevant to this presentation.
I have none.
Sorry, I'm not used to this disclosure slide. So. Before going into the actual work and the meat of the presentation itself, I wanted to give everyone kind of a community overview, and I think it's important to come in with this context before discussing the work. So we're a nonprofit based out of New Orleans East, and if you look at this map, it's a map of New Orleans and specifically Orleans Parish. New Orleans East is everything to the right of that black square on the in the middle of the map. And specifically, our community is Village de l'Est, which is the easternmost subdivision before you hit basically St. Bernard or St. Tammany Parish. And it's that dark red and black triangle to the upper right-hand corner. So essentially, our community is actually the largest concentration of Vietnamese Americans in southeast Louisiana. Most of our folks actually having come from agricultural and fishing backgrounds. So this is a really important context, especially when addressing the oil spill. So in terms of the migration patterns, our community members actually came to the United States in 1975 after the end of the Vietnam War. Were resettled to Fort Chaffee, Arkansas, a resettlement camp. And were then sponsored by Archbishop Philip Hanan to eastern New Orleans and other communities along the West Bank of southeast Louisiana. And upon coming to the United States, there was actually a very natural transition into the fishing industry because this industry was largely an industry based on labor by your hands. And so it was an industry that folks had to learn English to get into. And so this was really important in addressing the oil spill because at the height before the oil spill, it was reported about of the 40,000 Southeast Asians across the Gulf Coast, 1 in 3 were in the fishing industry in some shape or form. So whether it actually be out on the vessels, on docks, processing, distribution, or even owning docks themselves. And before the oil spill, according to the Workforce Commission, 2/3 of all shrimping vessels were actually Vietnamese owned. So that gives you kind of the context of the involvement of Vietnamese community members in the fishing industry. And other community aspects are important to consider is that Eastern New Orleans is 60% of the landmass, like I said earlier, but also has high rates of poverty, lack of access to transportation. It's a food desert, USDA identified food desert, so there's actually only one grocery store serving that entire landmass. And that grocery store actually took 2 years after Katrina to rebuild. And there's also a lack of access to healthcare. So until very recently, there were actually no hospitals in Eastern New Orleans post-Katrina or ambulatory stations. So that actually meant that if folks had a medical emergency, for example, you actually had to wait for an ambulance to come from the city, meet your needs wherever you are, and then actually drive back into the city for you to receive attention. So specifically, like I mentioned earlier, a lot of our folks were involved in the BP, in the fishing industry. So the BP oil spill in 2010 had a huge economic impact. So all those folks I talked about being involved in fishing, shrimping, on the docks, processing, were essentially unemployed overnight. And to a large part, were unemployed for a significant amount of time. So one of the things that we did was we stepped in as a community organization and organized our communities to figure out what key issues were. And of course, the pressing issue at the time was economic compensation and what are we going to do to get people back on their feet and restore their livelihoods. But another peripheral but very important concern that was discovered or flushed out through community meetings was that folks were very concerned about seafood safety and the impact on health and environment. And essentially, after the oil spill, we were inundated with a lot of university research. And this was kind of the model that we as a staff kind of fleshed out that we saw that we fit into. So essentially it's a very top-down hierarchical model where research institutions or universities or the government would come down with surveys or research designs that are already pre-made to us as a community organization and say, look, we have a goal of 300 surveys that need to be done. We need you to actually do them. And this happened pretty much multiple times a week for months and months after the spill. And this was causing something called that we like to call survey survey fatigue. On our part as community organizers, as people who are administering surveys, but also for community members who seem to be answering the same question over and over and over again, but would not be a part of the dissemination to actually receive the results of the surveys. So this is what a typical community organizing meeting or a community meeting looked like in those types of meetings. So you can actually, I think this is a very key illustration of that kind of relationship. So you see that community members are also wearing headphones or headsets, so translation was something that was a key part of our organizing, but also centered around one speaker or a few speakers. So this is something that we thought needed to be changed. So that's when Tulane and Washington State University came in and actually presented this idea of community-based participatory research to our community members. And this is kind of the model that we kind of thought illustrated that working relationship. So instead of research institutions coming in and saying, we have this research design or proposal and we need you to implement it on our behalf, what actually happened was with Dr. Wycliffe and some other professors from Washington State University sat down with us as a community organization and said, you know, we realize that there's an issue going on and we need your help and we want to actually address concerns that community members may have that are not being addressed by existing research. So essentially the model that we used was, on top of using us as a community organization, we thought it would make sense, because none of us are shrimpers ourselves as a community organization, to actually organize community principal investigators as representatives of the community in which they came from. And in this particular example, the community principal investigators that we did pull from were all shrimpers, whether it be boat owners, deckhands, or longline fishermen. So they actually had a working knowledge of the waters and the main issues that were going on. And before we actually got into the research itself, we actually conducted a survey to understand where community members were at. And I think one of the key things that I pulled away from the survey was how information is disseminated and trust factors in regards to information dissemination. So if you look at this slide here, it actually talks about how folks get information, but more importantly, what factors contribute to information being trustworthy for community members. So as you can see, overwhelmingly folks get information from close friends, relatives, and community meetings, even though at that time there were numerous BP meetings, government meetings, local government meetings as well to disseminate information. Folks were actually mainly getting information from close friends, community members, and family. In regards to trust factors and what it constitutes trustworthy information, overwhelmingly, folks said that if friends or family or people they trusted personally trusted that information or said it was true, then folks believed that. And actually, whether or not the person was an expert in the field played very little in that. And in addition, this was also really interesting. When asked who understood the effects of the oil spill, people overwhelmingly said that people in the community understood the effects of the oil spill, and scientists in regards to that, actually only 36% of folks said that they understood the effects of oil spill. And this was highlighted actually in a meeting that we had with EPA and NOAA, where they met with shrimpers and said, you know, we want to say that the oil is no longer existing in the Gulf. And the Schimpers basically stood up and said, I'm not a scientist, but I can tell you that water and oil don't mix. You can't tell me that the oil is all gone when I still have friends out there cleaning up oil. So there was a huge distrust in the community regarding this information. And more importantly, this kind of set the groundwork for the work that we were engaged in, is a lot of our community members actually said that a meaningful partnership between community members and scientists could actually solve issues pertaining to the oil spill. So I think this outlines actually the key issue regarding post-disaster research, is whether or not the information or research or data is true, whether or not it's trusted by community members actually is the main issue here. And that goes to the methodology in which we conduct research. So specifically around the BP oil spill, we held a lot of community meetings, but specifically we started with one-on-one interviews and group interviews to try and flesh out more in detail what community members had as their main concern. And then we brought that out in terms of larger focus groups and community meetings to basically start to vote and decide based on consensus or majority rule what things we want to look at and present the data that we got from one-on-one interviews. So you can see that this is actually a very different sort of situation and dynamic from the previous picture that I showed you with the community meetings. So you can see that folks are more in a circle. There's actually meaningful discussion, and actually, instead of community members wearing headsets, researchers were wearing headsets. So we actually got to flip the dynamic of what does language access look like. So here's again, it's hard to see, but on the wall there was actually writing about, you know, listing out what community concerns are, how we're actually going to go about the research. So the basis of our research, folks had numerous concerns around all types of seafood, but actually voted by democracy to focus on shrimp for this particular study that we engaged in with Washington State and Tulane. And from there, they actually voted to elect representatives to be principal community investigators. So this is actually a smaller focus group, even like a steering committee of folks in that as principal community investigators, to actually figure out, okay, so now we are tasked by the community to focus on shrimp as the main issue. So how are we going to actually go about doing that? So this is actually a meeting where we actually plan out where we're going to be taking shrimp, when are we going to be taking shrimp, and who's actually going to be with us taking shrimp. So this is really important to have community members actually engaged in the collection of shrimp data itself. So at the time, after the oil spill, one of the biggest issues was that community members didn't trust the data. And one of the factors in that was they didn't think that scientists or government officials or whoever else was doing research knew where folks were getting their shrimp from and were just taking arbitrary shrimp or water samples. And they said, you know, unless you've been fishing these waters for 30 plus 40 years or even generations like we have, you have no idea where to be taking oil or fish samples or seafood samples to be determining whether water or seafood is safe for us to consume. So community members actually taking time out of their shrimping season to actually help us collect data. So some pictures of the shrimping trip. So we actually used a trinet to pull up shrimp. And this was actually something that was really interesting that was unintentional from the research trip, was they were actually able to tell us some other things outside of the oil spill. So for example, after the oil spill, they had started seeing these shrimp with black gills. So that was something that we were actually able to look into, in addition to whether or not the shrimp was safe to eat from the oil spill, to address additional community concerns. And this is a map of where we got shrimp samples, and this is focusing more on the Chandler Bay. And this is actually a region where a lot of our community members actually shrimp. So most folks were, for example, collecting shrimp more down south towards Venice, but this area, for example, was in large part being overlooked. So the results of the Safe Shrimp study said that basically, overall, the shrimp was safe to eat. And I think one of the really interesting results of this study was what the community members decided to do with the data. So we actually came back and presented to the community principal investigators, you know, the shrimp samples say that the shrimp is safe to eat. What do we do now? The community members said, well, let's not disseminate it. Because they said that if we disseminate that the shrimp is safe, that assumes something was wrong with the shrimp before, and that would cause kind of public panic. But the overall basically attitude right now is folks are still going on eating shrimp because it's part of their livelihood, and they're assuming that there's certain levels of safety in it. And then, you know, so as community members, they decided not to disseminate the information. I thought that was really interesting. And so the next step is actually to flush out more long-term studies to look at Basically, the shrimper said, okay, so we determined that the shrimp is safe now, but what about 5 to 10 years from now? What effects does oil have, for example, on the reproductive capabilities of shrimp? Will it affect shrimp stock? Also, we're only looking at shrimp, but what about all the bycatch that we eat, such as anchovies, croakers, all these other types of seafood that are not getting the same publicity as shrimp in terms of the media coverage of oils, of the oil spill. So things like tuna, for example. And then outside of seafood safety, overall community concerns that existed even before Katrina or even post-Katrina around agricultural concerns, soil contamination due to landfills, water contamination, air quality. And I think this is actually a testament to the success of the community-based participatory research model, because community members actually thought it was successful, were able to be engaged in the research process, created data they trusted, but were willing to use this model of community-based participatory research and apply it to other concerns they had in the local region. And some of the lessons learned that we pulled away from this collaboration with Tulane and Washington State was that at the crux of our work, at least in the Vietnamese community, that language access and cultural competency was basically crucial. And it's highlighted by this one example, right? So after oil spill, BP had a lot of information sessions. Actually, one information session, they brought in interpreters straight from Vietnam, but they didn't realize that there's multiple dialects in the Vietnamese community. So they actually spoke in a dialect that local community members couldn't understand, and basically they said, we'd rather go on trying to listen in English than to try and listen in this other broken dialect in Vietnamese. And another instance was when the compensation process was going out. Ken Feinberg at the time, his first community meeting printed packets in Vietnamese, but actually didn't cross-check whether or not it was Vietnamese. So it was actually just broken Microsoft Word script. So community members got really upset at that and said, why didn't you even just cross-check if this was actually Vietnamese itself? So this is very key in terms of building relationships and meaningful relationships with community members, figuring out what the local culture is, and then especially language. And then we also learned a lot about effective information dissemination. Like you saw in the previous slides with the survey results, we basically, to this day and as a daily part of our work in terms of disseminating information, we don't print a lot of flyers, but it's a lot of word of mouth in what we call in the community using the grapevine. And working with communities is essential to success. You know, we realize it's kind of like the Galileo effect, I think. Like, if you have information that's, you know, 100% is true, but you can't get communities to believe you, then it's basically nil. And I think coming from a nonprofit perspective, one of the things that we find really important is to hire local nonprofits directly. So a lot of the things that were going on after this spill with universities coming in and administering surveys through us, we were often doing that pro bono on top of all the other work that we're doing that caused actually a lot of local staff fatigue. And I think that's something that I really commend Tulane in doing, is really respecting and honoring and really valuing our relationship and actually helping fund us to continue the staff capacity. Also hire locally, avoid survey fatigue, and then basically give communities part ownership of the data. And I think this is something that was really crucial, because community members decided not to disseminate that data, and they were actually involved in reading over academic journals before publishing. So I think this is something that helps solidify long-term relationships between research entities and communities. So thank you.
Thank you.
So I don't want to take too much time. I just wanted to follow up on some of the things that Daniel mentioned. My name is Jeff Wickliffe. I'm the Tulane partner that works with Daniel on a lot of the environmental issues that they're facing. One of the first things I'd like to emphasize is we talk about risk communication, and usually what that means to most people is talking and speaking. And I think one of the more powerful things that we can all do as communicators is listen. And I don't just mean stand there and make eye contact or sit there and make eye contact. I mean listen effectively. Daniel and my relationship is born out of a lot of work before the spill ever happened. It wasn't time that either one of us were really paid for. We just spent the time to try to get to know one another, get to know what one another's strengths were, weaknesses, expertise, what the issues they were facing were, and there's a multitude of issues. The issues that I face, so Daniel has a better idea of what academic researchers have to deal with and teaching and all the other responsibilities we have. So that's really what made this effective, is that we had a good solid partnership before the spill happened. So I was talking to Daniel the other day on April 19th, 2010. I was not an oil spill researcher. On April 20th, 2010, things changed a little bit. But because we had developed an effective partnership, and I did know what many of the members in that community did for a living, we realized that we had the chance to work with community members to address problems they had. And one of the first things we did was go listen to the community. Say, what kind of things are you concerned about? These are the things that we consider ourselves good at, that we can help with, and that's where this project emerged from. And another big issue, as Daniel mentioned, to these shrimpers was, where are they collecting these samples? They keep telling us they're safe and they're clean, but I don't know where they're from. Are they from the areas where we shrimp? And they asked, can we go collect shrimp where we shrimp? And the nice thing about the funding we got was we intentionally set it up so that the community would be involved in the development of the plan. Oftentimes that's not easy to do. As scientists, we like to develop the plan and then go say, help, you know, go help make this happen with us. In this case, it was different. So I think that's the other thing that made it so effective was we had all the stakeholders, from myself as a stakeholder to the community as a stakeholder, involved in the whole process. And then working with people like Daniel, who have very good relationships with their communities, very effective members, live in those communities, made this partnership particularly useful. The challenges we faced as scientists were that science and the technology, even though we acknowledge we know a little and there's a lot we don't know, there are technological capabilities that allow us to speed ahead. So a lot of the compounds we were able to look at in the oil, or in oil contaminated seafood, if that were the case, were compounds that we don't know much about. So I would say one of the other things that communities appreciate is when scientists say, this is what we know, and this is what we don't know. And I've heard that time and time again. The other thing I've heard from communities regarding what scientists say, oftentimes in comparison, and Ragnar brought it up, was a perfect case is dispersants. And dispersants remain one of the major health concerns in and around these communities to this day. Oil, not so much. People have grown up with oil and gas, they're familiar with it. Dispersants is new technology to most people, especially as applied to the oil spill, so they're very concerned about it. And some folks who were trying to communicate what dispersants are kept comparing it to Dawn, something you might use in your kitchen to disperse grease and oil. While effectively, that's how dispersants kind of work, people realized or really feel like it's not necessarily a fair comparison. So again, in terms of effective communication, because we are actually still actively working on developing frequently asked questions and answers to dispersants that the NIHS has charged us with, working with community to develop that information, because that's the other thing we've done with Daniel. When we're trying to explain to the lay public that may have a high school education what 2-methyl-dibenzene AH anthracene is and what we do and don't know about it, just the fact that you say that word scares people. It's a chemical. Chemical names are scary. I understand that. But we work with our community partners to develop the outreach documents. Certainly in the case of most of the folks in New Orleans East who speak predominantly Vietnamese, we have to do that. My understanding is, and Daniel can speak to this more, is that they don't have a lot of words for these chemical names. So how do you communicate something that has a chemical name to a community that does not have anything in their vocabulary that they can look to? And then the other thing we have that Ragnar brought up as well was sort of source of exposure, so the comparison of these voluntary risks. So I've heard a lot of folks talk about benzene, toluene, and these volatile organics that come out of oil, and that you're more exposed when you fill up your gas tank. That's not a very effective way to communicate that information. And I think Ragnar brought that up very well. That's another thing that we've talked about. And so we work our documents, our flyers, our dissemination and outreach materials through our community partners. They share them with members of their community. So when we're ready to send those back out, they've been vetted. You know, we can't change the name of benzene to something that somebody else is going to understand. It's just what it is. But we can try to communicate to these folks what benzene is in the manner they wish, which can be quite varied. Most folks, again, want FaceTime. They want you to go to their community. They want you to share the information you found. What have you found in our shrimp? What are you finding in our air? And what does it mean? And the last thing I'll leave you with is that, what's that?
I have 10 minutes.
Okay, is that the general public does not like probabilities. So when you start talking about risk probabilities, probability of health risks, probabilities of exposure, that does not resonate well with community folks. It really doesn't resonate well with me as just a regular citizen. They want to know yes or no. They want to know, is my shrimp safe to eat or not? And the question I usually get after I go through some explanation about what we found or what we didn't find, in this case with our shrimp study, we really found that the shrimp is safe to eat based on what we were looking for and when we looked. That's what they want to know. So at the end of the presentation I usually give, or the end of the discussion, because it's usually a discussion, they say, that's great. So you didn't find 2-methyl dibenzoate anthracene that you don't know much about in my shrimp. Will you eat this shrimp? And I have to say yes or no. So again, that's sort of the trade-off between where I live scientifically in this probabilistic world of, we don't know what's, we didn't look for all these different things, so can we ever say it's really safe, as opposed to the more black and white world of, what's the answer? What did you find? You did all this science, and what did you find? And then one last thing is that speaks to the value of science, in that what I've run across in a lot of our communities here in Southeast Louisiana is they don't value science much because they feel like it never really answers the question yes or no. It's always left with, we've got to do more research. The probability of this is 1 in some odd million. What does that mean? Yes or no? So I'll leave you with that.
And that leaves me...